Accession number 3835, Reel 1.
Colonel P.R. Mundy, take
yes.
One. Did you come from a military background, Colonel?
No, my father was a sailor. And I couldn't go into the Navy because my eyesight.
So you decided?
Well, my father decided for me I was to go in the Army.
What schooling did you have?
Hmm?
What was your formal education?
Oh, I started at St. Vincent's School in Eastbourne, and then I went to Eton, and then I went to a Crammers for a year, and then I went to Sandhurst.
What year did you go to Sandhurst in? What year did you go to Sandhurst?
Oh, 10. I was there all 10. We went in January or February. And we passed out, it was only a year then, we passed out in December.
Did you enjoy your time at Sandhurst?
Oh yes, very good indeed. I thought the tuition and discipline was excellent. All the officers who taught me were first class. And I have nothing but praise for the education at Sandhurst during the time I was there. We were a certain amount of discipline, of course, but we had a certain amount of free time. Three or four of us used to go to race meetings on Saturday afternoon, Sandown and Kempton and Newbury and so forth. We were all very close. And the atmosphere at Sandhurst at that period, of course, I can't think of any other, was, I should say, excellent. We all, as far as I know, one or two chaps fell by the wayside, of course. Well, there were about 180 of us went in. There was about 360, a little under, I think, because we got in without an exam, as I told you, because there weren't sufficient candidates to authorize a written examination. Medical, of course, you have to pass, well, that's all right. Everybody seemed to, I should say, enjoy themselves there amongst the students. We all got on very well together. I was in D Company, commanded by Major Halliday, who was a VC and eventually became Lieutenant General in the Royal Marines.
What did you...
Very nice bloke. And I must say, I thoroughly enjoyed Sandhurst. I thought the education was about the best I'd encountered in my scholastic days.
What did you do after Sandhurst, Colonel? Hmm? What did you do after Sandhurst?
I was commissioned in the South Wales Borderers, and I joined them at Chatham Barracks. Chatham must have been about April 1911.
You had quite a few Welsh-speaking recruits, did you not, at Brecon?
Well, that was more when the war broke out in 1914. I suppose we had a certain amount, but they weren't so prominent then. Now, they picked up the... Well, of course, there was education in the army then, educational chap. They went, I don't know what, two or three times a week they went for educational... teaching, but it was more noticeable when the war broke out, and all these chaps from the hills and the mines all joined up. And as I told you, they just, of course, they picked it up pretty rapidly, but to start with, they just didn't know what officers were talking about, and that's why there was a certain amount of, well, say confusion, but a movement in the ranks, which you don't expect, you know, when you give an order. Really, they were saying, well, what's the officer saying? Because he didn't calling them to attention, or soap arms, or quick march, or whatever the figure was. Well, it was just Greek to them, you see. They were trying to inquire as to what they should do. But it didn't last long, but it was quite obvious that the Welsh language was very prominent, I should say, particularly in the hills and particularly in the mines.
Where did you see service during the war?
I, first of all, I joined one of the, what was known as the Kitchener Battalion. We were out at the depot, and the officer commanding the depot, he went to promoted Lieutenant Colonel to command this newly raised Kitchener, known as Kitchener Army. Like, you heard about that, yeah. And we first went out to, we joined up, we saw we paid and had our training and so forth, and then the 13th Division, which we belonged, in the battalion, was in the, there were, you know, four battalions in a brigade and so forth. It's rather changed now, but in those days it was a four battalions in a brigade. And we went out to Gallipoli about May, I suppose, yes, about May 1915.
And you saw service at Gallipoli. What happened there?
Well, first of all, we were put into the trenches at Helles, which was as a new unit to war, I reckon was very valuable. We were there for about 3 weeks or a month. Then they took us out from Helles, and we went back to Lemnos, I think, for 3 or 4 days or so, and then we were sent to Anzac to assist the Australians and New Zealanders in the breakout, which was figured for the same time as the Suvla Bay landing, about August the 6th or some figure date like that, or maybe a little roundabout, might be early, might be later. I can't remember the exact date now. And we were pushed into Anzac as a reinforcement to the Australians at the same time as I say, the Suvla Bay landing took place. The chaps who landed at Suvla Bay were sent direct from Lemnos or some other one of those islands on the Suvla Bay. They went direct. We were housed in trenches, or rather, they had a little sort of cave they were dug out in Anzac. And then on the, I think it was August the 6th, neither of us, they started, the Anzac show started with a, it was a celebrated piece of ground known as Lone Pine Ridge, which had been a subject of considerable activity, shall we say, for some time. And the Australians then took it that night, or that afternoon. And we broke out from the left-hand side of Anzac. Was rather like that. Our Lone Pine Ridge was on the right. Here was the sea, and we were on the left, and we broke out from there to join up with the Suvla Bay landing, which took place at the same time. And we had a night show on the extreme left of Anzac, which we had to take a little ridge and occupy it and so forth, to join up with the landings at Suvla Bay. Which, of course, started very well, but then there was a certain amount of inertia. You've no doubt read all about that. A certain amount of inertia occurred, and instead of units going forward, they could have. The Turks were practically non-existent in Suvla Bay. They had posts on the shores of Suvla Bay, which were driven off by the landers. And then, I've got to say, a certain amount of inertia occurred. They could have gone forward without any opposition at all, as far as I can recollect. In fact, in front of our area, we could have gone forward. We were told to hold this ridge, you see. Whether the authority, the leaders, thought there might be a counterattack, and we had to dig in and so forth, which we did. But I walked forward about half a mile the night after our show, and there wasn't a Turk in sight. About 3 days later, no. No, about 3 days later, that fellow Mustafa Kemal got busy and shoved a whole lot of reinforcement, which he caught up from somewhere or other, and the whole place was alive with Turks then.
How long were you there at Gallipoli?
I left about September, I think it was. I got dysentery and enteric.
Where did you go after Gallipoli?
I went out to France in 15, in 16 rather, to our first battalion, which was Loos.
And after that?
After that, had some accident. I don't quite know what happened, but I bang on the head and so forth. I went out again to France toward the end of 16. I wasn't home very long, and I was there for all through the Somme show, and I was wounded in March, I think it was, 17. Went home, and then from there I went to our depot, for a bit, a reserve battalion up at Liverpool, and then I went out to, was posted out to Salonika.
And where were you at the end of the war?
The war finished, actually, in Salonika. Well, far as we go, the Bulgars gave in about, September, beginning of October, 18. They were the first to collapse. The first of the Entente, German-Austrian performance. They were the first to collapse in Salonika, and quite what happened, but they actually surrendered in about October, I think, 1918. And from there, we went on to. I went to rejoin after I was wounded there in the final show, and then I rejoined the battalion at Stavros, and I was posted to an army training school which they had going. We all went on to Constantinople. I was there for a year.
Where did you go after Constantinople?
After Constantinople. Oh, I came home and joined our... was it our first or second? First, I think it was. At Aldershot. And we went to... just after we joined, we went off to Ireland. The sort of same sort of show going on as it was now. It wasn't quite so violent. And I was there for about 4 or 5 months, and then I got appointed as military secretary to Lord Jellicoe in New Zealand. And I went out there, must have been about... we arrived, I think, about October or something, or maybe beginning of November, in 1920, I suppose, yes. And I was there for 3 years until I came home in 23, when I went out to India.
What rank were you when you went out to India?
Captain.
Where did you go after India?
We were about 5 years in India, outside Calcutta to start with, up at Agra. Then we went to Aden for 18 months. We must have come home about 29, I suppose. Yes, I think we came home to Portsmouth, 29, and then I went out to Tanganyika in the end of 29.
How, what prompted you to go to Africa?
Well, I got rather friendly with our local brigadier, Howard, Pompey Howard, he was known, a nice bloke. And he said, you know, Mundy, it'd be a good idea if you had a bit of service with the African troops. He was still a captain, you see. I haven't been a captain since 1914. And I applied to the colonial office for a job in the either the West African or the East African forces. And I went and had an interview with the staff officer of the Inspector General of the East African or the West African forces. And I got this job as Major, commanding the 6th Battalion of the KAR in Dar es Salaam, which was then, it was a 4 battalion, a 4 company unit, but it was decided that the battalion should be reduced to 2 companies and a machine gun unit and something else, some transport, mechanized transport, which came into force then. And so the rank was only major instead of it had been previously lieutenant colonel with a large full company unit, you see. And then, and with Havre, it was a temporary promotion for me and increased pocket money. More the major in the KR was a good deal more than you got as a captain in the regiment at home.
What were you paid as an acting major?
I rather think it was something like 800. It was something between 6 and 8, anyhow. A good deal advance of what, even if I was promoted major at home, it'd been, I think it was something between 6 and 8, yes. And, of course, you didn't suffer from a severe imposition of income tax. It's there, added. But I enjoyed my KR service very much indeed.
At your interview at the Colonial Office, what sort of things were you asked?
Oh, golly. They had the record of my service. I think I was asked if I was keen to go out to Africa, and I said yes, and had you ever been there before, and that sort of thing. I said no, because I hadn't been. Well, other than that, I suppose they asked what I'd done, and I'm afraid memory doesn't really recollect the questions that the staff officer put to me.
How did you go out to Tanganyika?
Oh, by boat. VI from Tilbury, I think, and then you went through the Mediterranean. They stopped at Mombasa for a couple of days, and then it was about a day's journey on to Dar es Salaam.
Did you ever have any second thoughts about going after you'd applied?
No. Oh, no. Oh, I was keen to go. Once I got the job, I was keen to go and get there.
Were you given any official advice as about what to expect?
I can't recollect it, no. No. I don't think so, no. You were just appointed and you went out to find out what it was like.
Were you given any hints on clothing?
No, I don't think so. They gave you the colonial office gave you an allowance. I think it was 50 quid or something to buy either at home or when you went to Dar es Salaam. It was, yes, that's about it, yeah.
Where did you buy your equipment?
I bought some at a shop in London, which wasn't, I didn't think, very good, and the rest I spent when I got out there, which was much more satisfactory, because you didn't want thick clothes and that sort of thing. You wanted khaki. We used to dress in the bush shirt, you know what an open thing, no tie, but open collar and shorts and stockings and putties. No.
What was your reception when you went to Tanganyika?
Oh, there was a colonel commanding the units. He had been commanding the battalion, and he was promoted to colonel, or he was a lieutenant, I don't quite know, can't quote me, but he was a full colonel, lieutenant colonel, I can't quite remember, but he commanded the troops in Tanganyika and Nyasaland. Well, I went and reported myself, and he said he'd be glad to see me, and so forth. And we got on very well together, and then I had an interview with the governor. I went to dinner with the governor or something like that, which was quite nice. Oh, yes, the reception, as far as I was concerned, was all that one expected. You weren't given flags and no reception. No, well, you didn't expect that. You just went out to join the battalion and take command, and you got on with the job. It was, and then we had these two outstations, one at a place called Mahenge in the southern part of Tanganyika, and then you had the other outstation at Arusha, which was up in the north, where the Mahenge was just there was a PC there. There were no Europeans, but of course up in Arusha there was all this coffee business, which was in those days flourishing, and the Kenya Tanganyika coffee ranked equal on the home market with the Kenya coffee, which was, the coffee was a valuable product, which there were quite a number of British settlers there who didn't own the land, you were hired the land, you weren't, because under the Tanganyika arrangement of the League of Nations, you could not buy land in European, you could hire it. You couldn't buy it in Tanganyika, as opposed to, of course, Kenya, where you could buy your land and own it. You could, I don't know quite now, there were lease terms, which I don't know, but you could lease the land for a certain, I can't remember, oh, I think quite a considerable period. It was, that was fostered in those days because it provided valuable employment for the native and also was, to a certain extent, in the government, it was valuable that coffee should be grown because the taxes and so forth were a valuable, and the development of the land by coffee people was extremely good. And of course there was in the south part up the country from Dar es Salaam, there was a big cotton estate, the Liverpool Uganda Cotton Company had a big holding there, and of course there was the Sisal as well.
What were your first impressions of Africa?
Well, I would say very favourable. I found everybody very pleasant. Europeans, made friends, quite a number of Europeans at Dar es Salaam and also up at Arusha and up at Morogoro. I got to know the chaps who ran the Liverpool. Who used to take football sides up from Dar es Salaam by train, and as I say, I think I told you after, we marched up to Morogoro and had a month's training up there, ran into this fellow who's named now, who's chief staff officer to Von Leto, a German. He ran an estate there. I forget now what he did, but anyhow, he's a very pleasant bloke. I think I told you, we went to do a bit of field firing, and he cleared the land so that I could use machine guns and rifles without endangering the local people. I went and had a look round before the morning before we actually started open fire, but he'd done his job. Yeah, he was a nice bloke. Oh, yeah, yes, I should think a pretty able staff officer. Well, he must have been to be staff officer to Von Leto throughout the war.
How was military life in Africa different than in Britain?
How did
military life in Africa differ from what you'd seen before?
Oh, well, of course, it was rather what you might call a minor scale. I mean, at home, the brigades were formed up for brigade training and that sort of thing. Well, of course, there wasn't enough troops for that sort of thing. It was just I did my own training with my unit, and I was the only unit, from a military aspect, in Tanganyika. Same as Kenya and Uganda. They each have their little small units of battalions. A battalion in Uganda and a battalion in Kenya. You see, there's no artillery or anything like that. I suppose the finances didn't run to it anyhow. They didn't think it was worth it, I suppose. They just had rather skeleton units which were capable of expansion, presumably if and when a war turned up, which in those days it was rather the reverse. Nobody thought of 1939. This was 10 years ahead of that. And all the idea was we try and sort of keep peace. Relations are very amicable. We've got on very well with the African. We wanted to go out and recruit, and the troops, we didn't recruit in Dar es Salaam because there was a certain amount of towny element growing up there, which wasn't very set.